Blog Talk Radio.
Supporting police officers with style and intelligence, it's time for Police Talk Radio, the fastest 90 minutes blog talk radio show today. Hosted by Ed Nowicki, along with yours truly, we have a great show in store for you today, so sit back and join in the fun. We'll treat you to some fascinating emotional conversations about our men and women blue. And remember, our chat window is open, or you can call in and join the conversation by dialing 602-753-1853. That's 602-753-1853. Now here's Ed.
All right, Jimmy, coming at you and all the listeners taking in Police Talk Radio. I want to talk to you a little bit about today is so special because it's Groundhog Day. And my co-host, we call him Junebug Jersey Jimmy. He saw his shadow today. He has no idea which side he's facing. And I'll leave it at that. But before I go into the topic at hand, which is police use of force, fascinating, misunderstood term that I hear. It's so important, but people are talking about it, and they're talking out of the wrong side of their body. But what I want to talk a little bit about now is what I saw going on, University of California at Berkeley, yesterday. I'm talking about the violence and the burning and the destruction of property, and pretty soon it will be people injured, police officers injured. Young lady wearing a Make America Great hat again. Well, I guess she wasn't popular with the group that was protesting. I shouldn't say protesting, violently creating a riot. And she was sprayed from very close range with pepper spray. That disturbed me very, very, very much because I know something about pepper spray. There's something called a hydraulic needle effect. When you put liquid under great pressure, when there's micro particulate matter, it could go behind the corneal epithelium, five layers to the eye. The outside layer repairs itself all the time. No problem. If it goes beyond the outside layer, the corneal epithelium, we're starting talking eye damage. So I don't know if that's going to happen to that young lady or not. But when I saw what went on there, it reminded me when I began my career as a City of Chicago police officer, sworn in on the 19th of February, 1968. They took me out of the academy when Reverend Martin Luther King was assassinated. I was there. Driving back abandoned police vehicles that were left, that were still drivable, that weren't burning. I had to bring them back, and naturally they stood around, and I was being covered, but that was my job. And we had something called the Democratic National Convention of 1968. At that time of the year, a lot of unrest in our nation, the Vietnam War. People in general seem to really hate police officers. Maybe you say to yourself, I don't remember that. Maybe you don't, but I do. As a young police officer, and you're beginning your career, you have a certain amount of pride. You want to feel good about what you're doing. Being a police officer, it was something that made you really, I don't want to say I was never ashamed, but you were cautious the way you were as a police officer with the public, because in general, everybody took flack. If you were a cop at that time, everybody took flack. That's just the way it happened, and I didn't care for it. Now I'm seeing this incident in Berkeley. Now, is this the first domino to fall? Will we be seeing more of this? I don't know. But what I know, I don't like what I did see. And I certainly hope we're not seeing more of it, because if we are, we have a serious problem. It's only going to get worse, and I hope it doesn't. I don't mean to put the gypsy curse on anybody. My apology to all gypsies out there that may be taking in this program, but I don't think we have many of them anyway. But anyway, it could be something to look, it may be a glimpse into our future. And the glimpse that we're going to see into our future isn't very happy if this is the start of things. And Berkeley is the place of supposedly the Free Speech University back in 1964. They became, you know, their, with their protests and the likes. What went on yesterday was not a protest. It was a violent, crime-ridden response to what a bunch of spoiled college kids didn't like. That's what it was, in plain, simple terms. We don't like it. We're going to try and burn you down. We're going to try and destroy university property. We're going to try and get this poor, this young lady wearing a hat, try and single her out, because these big macho tough guys wouldn't have the testosterone within them to take on any police officer, male or female. That's what a bunch of eunuchs, those, that group is. They are nothing but a bunch of harem guards. They could get a job at any time at any harem because they are eminently qualified. They are capons. You know what a capon is? It's a neutered rooster. That ought to tell you something. In essence, it's a ballless chicken. And that's what I saw yesterday. I saw ballless chickens out there trying to raise ruckus and give them hell, and because they didn't like what they saw. They didn't like what went on. We said, we're going to make it violent. You know what? You don't always get what you want in this life. That's just facts. Anyway, Jimmy, back to you. I'd like to, when we get a chance, we'll start going over to our topic at hand, which is police use of force.
Well, thanks, Ed. You know, from my perspective, everything that is going on, in, not only at Berkeley, but on the college campuses, in the high schools and everything, this has been long coming. There's doubts of what this country is even going to make it. With the political situation we have in Washington, D.C., there is some hope because we've elected a president that's decisive. We've elected a president that knows what he wants to do. But I grew up a Democrat. But you know what? This is not your father's Democrat Party anymore. These people are socialists now, and we might as well just cut right to the chase and call them what they are.
Well, my mom and dad and all my relatives were the same thing, straight, loyal, Chicago lever-pulling Democrats.
Absolutely.
But they'd still be voting for FDR if he was running for president. How many times I heard FDR, like he was the patron saint of all evil, that he was going to cure us. Now I hear patron saint of all evil. Now they're making the current president, Donald Trump. I heard Sarah Silverman today made a statement that she believes that the military ought to overthrow as president. The U.S. military. Can you imagine that? That mindless buffoon. You have these idiotic Hollywood people, entertainers. Why is their opinion more valuable than anybody else's? When I saw like Ashley Judd and Madonna and a bunch of other heads out there, these people wouldn't know common sense if it kicked them in the ass. And that's plain and simple the way it is. They're idiot people, and people are listening to them because they happen to be known as entertainers. Well, I talked to a gentleman, and I knew there was a stunt man. He was around a lot of actors. He said a lot of these actors don't have much personality because they're always assuming a role, and they never what role they're supposed to be. So when I saw them in the role of a political commentator, are the sorry sounding morons, and that's being complimentary, Jimmy.
Well, you know, from my perspective, Hollywood should act and should produce their art, or they should run for office, one of the two. I'm sick and tired of celebrities telling me how to run my life. I'm sick and tired of them thinking they're, as been stated in the past couple of weeks, Hollywood is the epicenter of all culture in this country. Well, you know, if I was a betting man, I'd be winning my bet because they're Hollywood.
And Jimmy, I'm assuming Jimmy's still on the air because I'm certainly not hearing him as I usually am. I'm going to go on as we're, that I plan to because I believe I'm still on the air whether he is or not. Anyway, back to you. Our call-in number, if you're interested, is 602-753-1853. I will repeat, 602 area code, 753-1853. If you don't want to call in, fine. I understand. If you do, fine. It's no, whatever is your preference. We'll leave that deciding factor up to you. We are now, I want to tell you a little bit about my background as far as use of force is concerned. What gives me a microphone to speak on this with any authority? I'll tell you right now, I'm not an attorney. I never was an attorney. I'm not an attorney now, and I have no plans on being an attorney. And if you really want to make me angry, you'll say, I wish you were an attorney. That is like the button for me. But my background is as a career-long police officer. I've been in it since, 48 years it'll be in a couple of weeks. That's a long time. You got to remember, I came on the job when I was 4 years old, so that's why I'm so young still. But talking now on use of force, I became a Chicago police officer. I was involved in 6 shootings during the time that I was on the job. One of them, I was out of state with my spouse, and we got into a shootout out of state. Strange things happen sometimes. My only saving grace in life at that time, as far as shootings were concerned, is that elephants didn't fly. Because if they would have, I'd have been in a hurt and trouble. But my background, was as a cop. I was 10 years on the job. I got a little frustrated. I was not going to be promoted because I was the victim of discrimination. There is no such thing as reverse discrimination. Like saying it's discrimination light. Discrimination is discrimination. No such thing as reverse. Either it is or it isn't. Plain and simple. Pregnant. There's no reverse pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. Dead. You're either dead or you're not. There are things that are absolutes. And I was a victim, and I did not like that. And my wife and I had a discussion. We wanted to move our kids outside the city. We had a residency requirement. And after 10 years, difficult time for me professionally because I loved the job. Last 6 years, I was a narcotics section detective, a very elite unit, only 60 people out of 13,000 officers that were part of it. I was very proud to work with the people that I worked with. We were a hard charging bunch. We did a lot of good police work together. We had a lot of fun together, too. What I found out, the longer you're a cop, if you're involved in, you know, human misery and suffering and seeing where the tube is stuck as far as the proctologist is concerned to give a social enema, that's the part of the body of society that you deal with as a cop, at least at that time. I don't think it's changed a whole lot, but it was a very tough time, and I went and worked for a suburb for a year, and then I was going to school. I got my 2-year degree, and I became a police chief in a small town. Finished up my 4-year degree at the time. Started working on my master's degree, and got it hired at a 2-year college in Wisconsin to run the police training programs there. I completed my master's degree program at through Webster University, off-campus location, Fort Sheridan Army Base in Illinois that I commuted to, and it was a just giving you a little bit of my foundation. I got involved in a lot of use of force training, ran to recruit school, ran police specialized training programs, brought a lot of people in. I had a lot of opportunities, and if you ever hear someone tell you, "Well, your degree got you the job," I want you to think about this. Ever they're telling you, "I don't care what it is, your degree never gets you a job. Your degree may get you an interview, but it won't get you a job. You get you a job, good, bad, or ugly. That's just the way it is. A lot of competition. You may be a good candidate, but they don't see you to be the best candidate." Anyway, and I got to experience a whole lot. I started an association with a number of other people. We grew to 5,000 people. I was involved in, I wrote probably, I think around 1,500 articles, but mostly police, but I also wrote articles. I had an article for Dog Fancy. I had an article for Western Horseman. I had a lot of interviews for, I wrote a lot of articles for a lot of different periodicals, Navy Times, American Bartender, National Teacher Magazine, plus mostly police. And I did a lot of research on police use of force. I worked still state part-time as a police officer working because I wanted to keep my foot in it. And I learned a lot, became an instructor in many different physical skills, and probably one of them, when I look at that, at the time now, it's been over, man, it's a long time ago, like 25 years ago, I was involved as a police use of force expert, the federal trial involving the four police officers, Sergeant Stacy Kuhn, Officer Lawrence Powell, Officer Theodore Brasino, and Officer Timothy Wind, that were criminally charged. They were not convicted in state court. When you're a police officer, the feds get a second shot at you. If you're a private citizen, they don't get that second shot. Being a police officer, because you work under color of law, they went after these officers criminally. I thought these were criminals. I thought they were horrible. I was going to be, and somehow the federal government heard that I spoke out publicly. They called me and asked me if I would be an expert. And I said, sure. I said, I don't know what the hell you need an expert for. My eyes can see what your eyes see. There's nothing to it. It's a slam dunk. It's a no-brainer. And there was more to that. They flew me out to California, Los Angeles, went to the United States Attorney's Office, and I saw the video. And we all seen the 6 to 8 to 9, maybe even 10 seconds of video that we've all seen ad nauseum. If you're over 35 years old, you know what I'm talking about. If you're under 35, you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. And you really know what I'm talking about if you're 35 plus. If you're 45 and plus, you know the case pretty, or at least what the media portrays it to be. I don't know how many people know this. The video starts off, the video is 3.5 minutes long. From when it starts it's off to when he's finally, King under control, is just under a minute. And the way it starts off is, I saw it being recorded, this was shown to me, Rodney King gets up off the ground, has his arms out, and charges the police officers with his arms outstretched. He honestly slips and falls. He goes down because he was drunk drinking Old English 800 malt liquor. He might have had PCP, but because of the drug, the type of test they gave him, alcohol would have masked the analysis of PCP at that time. And he wasn't. He wasn't under the influence that we know of. It wasn't provable. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. And he starts off, and I'm watching this. He was tasered twice. I mean, twice. Somebody jolted him with a taser. 50,000 volts of electricity surged his body. He grimaced, he groaned, he moaned, he complained, he made guttural noises. For one time, it didn't take him down. Second time, they hit him. When he's down the ground, he being Rodney King charging the officers. I'll admit the video does not look good on when you see it, especially the way the media shows you a selective excerpt of the 10 seconds. I mean, I wonder how many people out there will listen to this live or the podcast that will be listened to. How many people know that he was tasered twice? How many people saw more than the 6 to 8 to 10 seconds of video that was shown ad nauseum around the nation? In fact, it got to the point, it was ludicrous the way the media, they're rotten, no good scumbags. As far as I'm concerned, President Trump is right. The media, in my opinion, they're there to make money. As long as you understand that, that's the capitalist way. Therefore, to make money, they have to have good ratings. In order to get good ratings, you have to have listening. And if you have people listen, you're making money. It's advertising dollars. So as far as I'm concerned, the days of a journalist are done. We have people that are regurgitators, commentators. They're commentators. They're editorializers. They are not journalists. The art of journalism, is, if it's not dead, it just about is dead. Anyway, when I look at that, they're to make money. As long as you understand it, they don't care what how they do it. So any time they showed a video for about 10 years afterwards, or talked about a case, I should say, to do with police officers using excessive force while they were talking about it, they showed the Rodney King video playing behind. Now, what they're doing, they're manipulating thought process. When you see this, you're thinking, oh, yeah, that's horrible. They're talking about another police use of force incident. Rodney King, I know the way them no-good rotten cops were. I saw that video. Sure. They're planting seeds. And not only do they plant the seeds, they heavily fertilize it. I mean, heavily fertilize it with tools of shit, and I'll heap bullshit after bullshit upon it. Gotta remember, you look at what is reported to you. Please don't swallow hook, line, and sinker. Be a discriminate viewer, a discriminate reader, a discriminate listener. You need to take it upon yourself to do so. It's incumbent upon you to do so. It's a responsibility for you to do so if you want to understand the way things really are. And that case really opened. Remember, the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis. Well, as far as police use of force concerned, the book of Genesis for police use of force was with Rodney King. Opened it up for unbelievable lawsuits. What's the motivation for lawsuits? I want you to remember, before I go too heavily down this path, what's going on with lawsuits? A department will be sued for $3 million, and it makes big headlines. Then later on, you'll see something. Department settles out of court settlement. What they'll do is they'll make an out of court settlement. The sum is usually held where either side is supposed to publicly acknowledge how much it is. Sometimes that $3 million lawsuit will be satisfied for $30,000. Well, $30,000, usually with attorneys, but whatever is easily divisible by three. Their fee is one-third. And anyway, I'm adding a little bit of salt. It really bothers me. When you think about this, when you think about what they do to people's lives, I just get so angry when I think about police use of force. They'll settle that case, though. They'll say, oh, yeah, the cops must have done something wrong. But they'll do. They could settle the case. It'll cost them $30,000. The insurance company that insures your village, your city, your town, they'll say we could settle it for $30,000 to mount a defense of the case, to line up the experts, to get the attorney to defend it. It's going to cost us $50,000, and we don't know what the outcome is. There's been already cases where didn't think the cops did anything wrong. They awarded $1. Well, no, what? They were also responsible for reasonable attorney's fees, which have been six figures. These are games that are played all the time. Therefore, they'll spend for nuisance value. The insurance company looks at, hey, $50,000, we settle it for $30,000. Therefore, we save $20,000. Hell, I don't know about you people. Hell, would like to save $20,000. That's a pretty good chunk of change. 20 grand, come on. That's a lot of money. But when you look, that's the way the insurance company looks at it. do when you're reading the newspaper or you hear word the case was settled out of court for a unspecified sum. Well, right away you think, well, the cops must have did something wrong because they settled it. Not necessarily so. In fact, my experience is they settle them like that. When they settle a case like that, it usually is because the case was somewhat sure. That means that they felt strong, but it was, you never know what a jury's going to do. You know, you're talking 12 people. They say 12 people that are dumb enough not to know how to jury duty. Well, I don't think it's that way. I think all people that get there are typically good people. Sometimes good people are led down a wrong path. And when good people are led down the wrong path, they have problems. And the problems that happen when good people are led down the wrong path is a terrible verdict. I've never seen a verdict that should have been against a police officer that they want. As a use of force expert, I've testified in courts in California, in Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, Illinois, federal courts, state courts, disciplinary hearings. I testified virtually every type of venue. Pennsylvania, all over the place. I gave I was testifying in front of a jury way of a telephone because I was going to go out to Pennsylvania because my wife had an operation. I wasn't going to leave. Plain and simple. You either get it over the phone or held me in contempt or whatever you got to do because I wasn't leaving. But anyway, they did that. And when you see police use of force, now, Supreme Court, I'll tell you, one case where I think the Supreme Court really got it right. Sometimes you wonder, how the hell can these Supremes believe the way they believe and have a verdict? This is why I think the current Supreme Court nominee, President Trump, is an important one, and it's important that that person be brought into the U.S. Supreme Court. It is important because that person will be on there for decades, and they're around, and they're rendering opinions for decades. Boy, all you want people is to be fair and to look at it, in a perfect world, you want people that are slanted left or slanted right. Well, human beings are human beings. They're always going to be a little bit of slant. That's what things are. But I think the right jurists, try to do responsibly. And being a member of the Supreme Court, they want to do a good job, render a reasonable decision. But what they did, a landmark case, this is a beautiful case. And I want to get into it a little bit, but co-host here on the line with me trying to give me signs. Hey, you got to slow down. First of all, I have two speeds, 2 miles an hour and 190 miles an hour. That's it. That's what you get. What we got going on here, Junebug Jimmy?
Well, just as an update, we're still chat room's open, and we're still waiting for some live callers. Just if you folks remember, you're listening, you want to give us a call, it's 602-753-1853. That's 602-753-1853. The live chat room's open. We'd like to hear from you if you've got something to say. Ed, I'm going to give you a break here. We're going to take about a two-minute break, and I'm going to play a little bit of music. And we'll come right back with more of the use of force and their issues and what Ed's got to talk about in just about 2 minutes. So see you on the backside of the break, folks.
Law and the law one.
rebellion, you got a little Bobby Fuller, and I thought the law and the law won. We're talking about use of force tonight. Again, the telephone number is 602-753-1853. That's 602-753-1853. The chat room is open. We hope you're enjoying the show tonight. Ed, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
You know, Jimmy, we did that nationally syndicated talk radio show. We were like in 130 markets, and it's, you know, like anything else, Blog Talk Radio isn't that where still broadcast radio is. So before we get a what we'd call a base listeners that will not be scared, oh, I'm too scared to call in. A lot of times, if you want to call in, you have a question, ask it. If I can answer it, I'll answer it. If I don't know, I'll tell you I don't know. I'll try to answer. I don't BS anybody. I've been too far in my life along in order to start that kind of nonsense at this stage of my game. The case, though, he's talking about police use of force. This is where the Supreme Court got it right. If you want to look up this case, you can. It's a 1989 decision. It's called Graham, G-R-A-H-A-M, Connor, C-N-O-N-N-O-R. 1989, and it set the federal standard concerning police use of force. If you want to research that case or any case, I'll tell you a great resource. You won't need to spend a lot of money or anything like that. It's not like Westlaw, some of our website. This is free. And go to FindLaw, www.findlaw.com. We don't get a for a kickback or anything. I'm just telling you because it's a good resource. To find out some case law or Supreme Court or state Supreme Court or appellate court or any kind of law in and of itself, go to findlaw.com and start, you'll get an answer. May not be the answer you want, but you'll get an answer. What Graham versus Connor did, it set a standard, and the Supreme Court, they were infinitely wise when they looked at this case. They realized a lot of this is their own language. I'm repeating back to you. They said police officers are involved in incidents that are tense, certain, and rapidly evolving and should not be viewed upon with 20/20 hindsight. That's what they said. You can't look at it with 20/20 hindsight. Now, you may have heard this said that the reasonable man is what's to be used as a judge, the reasonable man. No, the Supreme Court says no. It's an extra standard that we're saying, which is good. What a reasonable man or woman would do, but what would a reasonable police officer would do, an experienced reasonable police officer, would that officer deem the use of force to be, there's a difference, I want you to understand terminology, reasonably necessary, not the same as necessary. Reasonably necessary is the factor that the Supreme Court uses, and the reason why it's so important. I think police agencies, and I'm talking big ones, if any police department out there has this standard, you're giving yourself an impossible standard. If you say, what force can an officer use? Minimum amount of force necessary to overcome resistance. Anybody explain that to me? What the minimum amount of force necessary to overcome resistance is? Because I have no idea what means. I'm clueless about it. All it says is, you know, one officer, they're saying reasonably necessary. One officer could decide the guy's fighting with the officer. One officer decides to punch the individual. Another officer decides to use a baton strike. Another officer decides to use pepper spray. Another officer decides to use a taser. Which one of those are minimum? Is minimum? Well, I don't know which one. If you do, I don't know what they're. But they're all reasonably necessary. They all fill, you know, that same area, that same void. Officer responds. It's reasonably necessary. It can be any one of those factors, or even other things. Now you got to understand too, when a police officer uses something, well. Way we look at things. Hands of a trained professional police officer, a police baton is an impact weapon. an impact weapon which is used to strike individuals, causing possibility motor function or possibility breaking of bones. It's a non-lethal force option. Not a very low one, but it's a non-lethal force option. I wouldn't use it against somebody that's just don't put their hands behind their back. I'm not going to walk up and strike them with a baton. If I could grab their hands, put them behind their back, then that's fine. Using a baton would be wrong. And that's not reasonably necessary to do so. However, you take that same baton, you get into a fight with somebody, and you get, I mean, they're all ready to rip your off. I mean, they really want to get into it with you. Get that baton. That becomes a deadly weapon to the officer. The officer's hands, it's not a deadly weapon. It's an impact instrument used in normally under lethal force situations. In a person's hands, in an assailant's hands, it's a lethal weapon, a deadly weapon. For the proper response, the police officer confronts a deadly weapon. The proper response is the use of deadly force, which is typically using a firearm, shooting somebody with a firearm. Typically the handgun, where do they aim? Why can't they shoot the baton out of their hand? Let me tell you, if you've been in a use of force situation, if you've fought with somebody, you got that adrenaline going, you got that blood pumping, you got everything going, you pull your firearm, you know where you tell officers to shoot? Center mass, because from 7 yards away, 21 feet, reliably hitting a center mass of a human silhouette inside the middle is very, I'm telling you right now, not all police officers get 100%, not even close to that. And that's why we try to make our police training more reasonable. What do we do now? Well, when I went through the police academy, we went through, you stood there and you did a camp parry, what they call action, and you put your one left hand in your pocket if you're right-handed. You shot with your right hand, you cock it and shoot. We had revolvers then. That type of shooting is absolutely, virtually 99.44% useless. It taught you nothing about police combat shooting. But when you see police officers do combat shooting, tell them center mass. You can't hit, shoot him in the knee. Shoot the gun out of their hand. Shoot the knife out of their hand. I want you to look at a deadly force in this situation. Somebody's fighting with me with their hands. Chances are, I don't think they're going to kill me unless there's some, you know, disparaging difference between myself and the subject. But, you know, it's really not a deadly force situation. It really isn't. Now, when we're involved in deadly force situations, someone's got a knife. So, well, that's not like a gun. You're right. It's not like a gun. It's like a knife. How deep does a wound have to be to potentially lethal? 3 millimeters. How do I know? Not because I said. I talked to an emergency room physician, and that's what an emergency room physician told me. I got that physician's name. I got what hospital they were with. I wanted to know. 3 millimeters, it's less than a quarter of an inch in the neck area because of all the vital structures in the neck. That's where it can be deadly. So, now we're looking at this. If someone's attacked, a baton is used to someone's down. So if they're fighting me, I hit them with a baton, it slows them down. It slows down bodily function. Attacking me with a knife. Let me ask you this, people. If someone is attacking you with a knife, do you want them to stop or do you want them to slow down? If you're most appropriate a level of force response most situations is a firearm. That's the appropriate force level response. It is. When we look at it in those terms, we can't shoot. Yeah, you know, the taser helps, but the taser only helps. We have it. Because not everybody, does a taser work on everybody? Some people, it's unbelievable, it hits me, but I have a very high pain tolerance, and I could pretty much take a whole lot. You'll take a whole lot before you're going to put me down because of the mindset. I try to remember that mindset. Takes me a while to think. You know what it means? I'm too stupid not to give up. Maybe that's what it means. But we try to get our officers, and again, we got to be careful about it because we want them to never give up. That's one thing we try to instill also. The deadly force situation, someone's attacking you with a knife, you want them to stop. How do you stop them? Use your firearm. Plain and simple. I think use of force, nothing is plain and simple. But under, and I'm starting to sound like an attorney, and I'm cursing myself. I'm not an attorney, never was an attorney, don't plan to be an attorney. I'm a use of force practitioner who's been recognized and qualified to give expert testimony. This expert testimony, I can give my opinion. Experts give their opinions. Therefore, I can give an opinion about the use of force. I can give my opinion as an expert. We look at police use of force. None of this stuff is in a vacuum, people. Things change all the time. I mean, even though I'm looking at it as an expert, I'm saying the standard, how would a reasonable officer respond? That's the standard I look at when I used to do expert witness testimony. I'm not doing it anymore. Plain and simple, I have a hard time traveling because of some physical medical problems that I have. And traveling for me is very, very, very difficult. And I had more work than I could handle. Because you give it to him straight. I have my man Jimmy in here. What goes on here, Jimmy? What are you talking about? What now?
Well, you know, Ed, from the standpoint of use of force, I've been one of your followers, your students, your good buddies. I traveled the country with you a few years ago when we were doing nothing but use of force training. And we've seen this whole issue run the gamut from when officers were really fired up and they're really confident going in the street. They knew what they had to do. They knew that they were basically coming home at night. They weren't going to jail and they weren't going to lose their job because they were trained and they wanted to go out there and do the job and they were prepared to do the job. A lot of that's starting to change. Our young brother who fought a violent battle for his life, Mark, can't remember his name from Ferguson. Man's never going to go back to law enforcement and he's under a constant guard. The column I wrote several years ago in the old Use of Force Journal, After Force. I think I aptly named it because After Force is the what happens to you when you do apply force in any situation. And more now, officers are being crucified. They're, you know, people are burning towns down because they used force. And what we're seeing today is we're seeing a reluctance on the part of some of the officers on the street, not all of them. We're seeing a reluctance on their part to dive into the old, like we did in the old days. And I'm not saying we're doing anything right and they're doing anything wrong, but what I'm saying is that hesitation that they're trying to create, this whole thing, let's talk, don't hit. It's going to get young officers killed because we're thinking more politically than we are tactically. And this whole movement of social justice.
We have police officers more worried about being sued than they are protecting their life, Jimmy.
Well, not only that. They're more worried about people with video cameras than they are people that are armed. Because unlike civilians, and I want to make this point, and I want to make it very clear to people, unlike if I go to work and I'm a truck driver and I get a ticket or I end up doing something wrong, that's not going to affect my whole family. If the young officer on the street with the young kids at home has them in school and locally life is good, and that fatal day comes when he's got to drop the hammer on somebody, Now all of a sudden he's a killer. Now all of a sudden people want to kill him. He wanted to kill his family. You have to put the family in protective custody. And this is happening more and more. And the point here, folks, is you don't have to make those decisions. Young officers, and not young and old officers alike, anybody that's wearing a badge on the street enforcing the law may at some time in their career come to the point where they have to use their firearm or some other type of force that may cause great bodily harm or even death. And why we train to do responses, automatic responses. We don't want you thinking about something. We want you, under stress, revert back to your train. Because if you start thinking about something, the officers are going to have that hesitation factor, and it may or may not get them killed. And that just doesn't happen in anybody else's job. It's very unique to law enforcement. It is unique to law enforcement. No other job that can say that on. And that's part of the problem we're having with the media. Ed, I recall a case where you were still at the school, a Milwaukee County assistant district attorney, wanting to charge a young officer for, I think it was a knife case. I may be wrong with that. But
it was. It was a knife case.
Okay.
And
go ahead and tell a story, because I think that's a story worth sharing.
Well, what happened is I got a call from an investigator with the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office that I knew. And she called me and she said that there's an officer from such and such police department, one of the Milwaukee suburbs, not the city, that, you know, I think, you know, the officer did what's right. He says, but we have this prosecutor. She wants to charge this officer. I said, can you do me a favor? I said, I don't want to call her. Can you do me a favor and ask the prosecutor if she'll talk to me about it? Talked with me. And I said, in fact, I talked to her and I said, listen, ma'am, I'd like for you to come down to where we do the training, and we'll do some of this training. And we had rubber knives and we had blank guns and all. I mean, we had all kinds of stuff to make it realistic. And I said, why don't you come down here and we'll show you what we're doing. We did that, and then we put her in the training. She was shooting people that shouldn't have been shot, was not shooting people that should have been shot. And she had a whole different view on the way things were. She went from about to criminally charge a poor officer to the point of almost recommending this department commendation for what he did. We have people in prosecutors' offices. We have people in. I had a major police agency, and I won't mention it. Their internal affairs division. Well, the Graham versus Connor case has been around since 1989. These affairs people are investigating excessive force complaints against police officers, and naturally, is it important these people should? No, Graham versus Connor? Yeah, did they? No. And I look at that. And not everybody knows what they should know. And we got to, that's why today, my oldest son, he's third generation law enforcement officer in our family. I got grandkids. You know what? I'm doing everything I can to not encourage them going to law enforcement. I never encouraged my son, but he kind of picked up on it. Grandkids, you know, you say little things here and there. I'd be very, very hesitant. Even back, when I was a narcotics cop in Chicago, I must have been stuck by hypodermic needles 15 times. And now we're talking all kinds of, you know, HIV, hepatitis C, and tuberculosis, by the way, is making somewhat of a comeback. There's some of these things that are happening, and you're going to say to yourself, am I going to expose myself to this for what I'm being paid? When HIV was probably about 20 years ago, it was still a real, more a serious concern. It still is, but I mean, more at the forefront then. I talked to a doctor, and this was a case. A guy bit his lip open, he had blood. His hand handcuffed. He's started spitting all over the cops and said, he's has HIV and he's AIDS positive and he's spitting on him. I said, ask the doctor, if that was you, doc, what would you have done? He says, I'd have shot the guy. Doctor told me that. I asked the prosecutor, I said, let's say I'd have shot this guy. What would you have done? We'd have charged you with a crime. I mean, that's what, and you got people making decisions. First of all, everybody knows what they should know. And not all police training is where it should be. We try to make our training realistic, relevant to the real world. And we're not wasting our dollars, people training our officers in skills that they'll never use or rarely use. What determines an officer's training need? Criticality of the task, that means potential for life. Criticality, the frequency of the task. You don't know how to write a traffic ticket. Nobody's going to die whether you write a ticket or not, although the city may say, we need more money. But that's going to be, a good thing is that's going to be, the cops giving tickets are going to be a lot more infrequent for the motorists because they're going to be doing everything with computerized, with cameras. They have speed limit signs. They have turn signal, turn signs, stop and go lights, all of this, all being computerized. You get a ticket in the mail from RoboCop. So a lot of cops are not going to be writing tickets anymore. And that's kind of a good thing that came about. But when it comes to use of force training, I'm going off on little tangents here, and I got to watch that because there's so many tangents that I could go on that are there. We need to have an understanding, and I think what's good for you, and we're going to have Jimmy and I were talking about this, June Bug Jimmy, my partner here in crime, talking about having a show in the future on Citizens Police Academies. I'm telling you now, I'm not going to go into it, but I'm telling you right now, if your city, village, town offers a Citizens Police Academy, usually 30 to 40 hours in length, either 3 to 4 hours for 10 weeks or twice a week or every Saturday for 8 hours or 4 hours on a Saturday, whatever it happens to be, to 40 hours, they put you through a citizen, in essence, mini police academy. Now, they've already done this unbelievably. They put real people that hated police officers, they put them through shoot-don't-shoot situations, and then they saw the police officer's point of view. And I'm going to tell you, video camera is going to straighten that out. Well, first of all, the video camera on police officers may or may not straighten that out. Oh, the video doesn't lie. Well, I want you to understand this. Please think about it. The video is a two-dimensional representation, three-dimensional event from one specific angle and one specific focal point. Without taking in ambient noises, things not viewable by the camera, like potential adversaries or other officers or there on the scene, it all tell you volumes as to what went on. Theoretically, you'd like a close-up and then a far away. It doesn't have, and then it all depends where you're standing. We did research on this. This is where I know. I had police recruits. I put them standing around a circle. Then we did a police use of force. One side, they saw the guy started grabbing his fist, going to punch the cop, making facial signs, and you knew this cop was going to be punched by this guy. If your back was to this guy, you never saw any of it. But the people that saw this individual's back looked like this was an unprovoked attack by the cop. It wasn't. But they saw what the officers saw, then they were able to put it. The people on the side, sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they filled in the blank, didn't know. They just filled it in by their own. You learn a lot about human nature when it comes to reports like that are concerned. What we always tell our officers, good, bad, or ugly, tell the truth. We always tell the truth. Never tell them you fudge. Oh, you, the way you creative report writing. No, there's only one way to write a police report, and that is be accurate. That's the only way. That's the only way you should ever want to write a police report is by being totally accurate when you're doing it, and give your perspective. And you have to draw the line between, is your opinion make something? Yeah. We put officers through training. If you ever saw something, we go into literal meaning of words. Then you go voice inflection. You should call that paralinguistics. Then you talk about distance. That's proxemics. Then you talk about kinesics, which is body language. Those enter into it. If you want to read a great book, the book's over 50 years old. It's called Body Language and by Julius Fast, and it's probably being updated. There's another one called The Naked Ape. Now, I forgot who the author is. Then there's another book written by a former police officer. Really, really very good. Very good book. Management of Aggressive Behavior. It shows you when assault is possible and when assault is imminent. These books give you insight into the way police officers deal with the use of force, by them recognizing these certain signs. The way I say something, you could say something sarcastic. How you doing? Oh, I'm having a wonderful day. It's anything but. Or I could say it literally. I'm having a wonderful day. That means I'm having a great day. It is a wonderful day. Read a transcript, it doesn't say the officer's voice inflection meant that the officer thought this. No, there's nothing like that. Nothing happened like that. It's not going to happen like that. And Jim, you know what I'm talking. You wrote enough police reports. You know what I'm talking about, Junebug.
No, absolutely. You know, from a standpoint of what where we're at now and I started anyway, you know, 18 carbon copies trying to push the pen through, and then several bottles of liquid paper later, I got my report written. Now everything's all computerized, and you can bang on a police report in about 4 or 5 minutes on the word processor and on your computer in your car. It's a lot different nowadays. But, you know, Ed, I want to throw out the telephone number. The telephone number is 602-753-1853. That's 602-753-1853. The chat room is open, and it's time for us. I can't believe it. We've gone through an hour of this show already. But we're going to take a little pause for the cause here. And again, I'm just going to tell you a little bit of music, and we'll see you in about 2 minutes on the other side of this song. So be right back. we're back. We've got about a half an hour left in the show. It's gone real fast, as I thought it was. Again, I want to throw out the telephone number. It's 602-753-1853. That's 602-753-1853. And we have generally been doing shows every 2 weeks. We're going to take a break on the 14th, I believe. I will be out of town and will be unable to participate. The 16th, correct me. The 16th. So next week, we'll do a show on the 9th. We'll be posting it here shortly to let you know what the topic's all about, but you can rest assured it'll be something that you want to hear. So, Ed, let's go to this
all
final
right.
half
we're
hour
back
segment.
In. And I want you. People here to understand something also. Again, I don't give the number out enough. Everybody tells me, get out the number. 602-753-1853. Don't be bashful. I don't bite. Well, maybe sometimes, but 602-753-1853. That's our number here at Police Talk Radio, and that's the name of the show, Police Talk Radio. I hear people talking, and I see these people. I went up against a lot of experts that went, testified on the other side. My favorites are these academics. And don't get me wrong. I believe I'm a bit of an academic myself. But I believe, you know what your education helps you do as far as police work is concerned? It helps you sell experience. You've never put a set of handcuffs on anybody ever in your life. Hell, are you going to tell me realistically from a practitioner about use of force that I don't know already? Because you don't know. You haven't done it. You haven't walked a mile in a police officer's shoes. That doesn't mean you're going to agree with everything. I saw cases officers did wrong. The attorney said, well, can you help us out? Well, probably not. You want me to help you out? Settle the case. It's a bad case. Settle it. Bad case. Cut your losses. Spend the money. What the cop did, I think it went beyond the realm of reasonable. That's my opinion. You want to do it? Do it. You don't want to do it? Fine. I'll be your expert. Just so you understand that. And usually when I said that, they do. But I see these people, these fucking heads sometimes. They'll get, I saw them recently talk. They don't even know the law. They say, oh, you got me for stopping under a Terry stop. Well, the reason they call it a Terry stop, because it was 1968, I believe it was 68 decision, Terry versus Ohio had to do with stop and frisk. When you believe a crime was happening, was about to happen, or just happened, stop somebody and maybe frisk them. If they had a reasonable, while they were hanging in front of the jewelry store, I work and my wife's going to bring me my lunch and I'm waiting before I go in to go in there and give me the lunch and embarrass me. That sounds reasonable. Okay, you give a free. I don't necessarily frisk you. That's no big deal. Fine and dandy. The way they have it in Chicago now. I talked about this last week. In Chicago, you have to fill out about a page report if you stop someone. God say, have a nice sir. Anything pretty much beyond that, you got to fill out a 2-page report. They made, I could clear Chicago. I guarantee it. I could clear Chicago's homicide rate. I don't want to say clear it. I can drastically reduce it within 1 month after implementing what I'm saying can be implemented, easily implemented. And what they have to do is they have to get stopped and frisked. They have to get to use it again, not where they have it. So, and you know what's happening now? The honest, and I worked, you say, on the minority community. When I first came on the job in Chicago, I worked in an all minority area. I grew up in Chicago. I was familiar with minorities. I never worked in an all minority area as a cop. That was my. My baptism. That was my that's where I learned how to be a cop and honest, law abiding people, which are the vast majority of minority members, want to be protected by the cops. They love good policing. They're afraid to say anything. They're afraid to stand up. They're afraid to give their opinion. The same reason why when Wilson. The officer involving that, you know, that this guy, the teenager, Michael Brown, he was a, he j- Trump didn't know that. Of course he didn't know that. But doesn't it give you a little insight, maybe just a wee bit, about the type of individual this was, a violent person? Then maybe gives you a little bit. People came out and spoke for Wilson. They sealed the grand jury minutes. The people didn't want to be identified. It had to be under anonymity. And let me tell you, Attorney General at that time was Eric Holder. If they could have found a way to go after Wilson and criminally charged him, they would have. And they didn't charge him. That was how strong the evidence was against Michael Brown. So you get this, oh, he's just a big old, he's just the kind of this smiling, gentle giant. Well, you know what? Green giant is not real, and neither was this guy, Michael Brown, being a nice guy. He was not a nice guy when Officer Darren Wilson confronted him. Not the person he faced. And again, I don't know any more or less than you do listening to this show, but I probably have a little different insight from working in the field of law enforcement and working as a use of force expert. And you know what? I felt so strongly about that case, I would have testified. I wouldn't have taken any fee. And believe me, you could get paid. Your rate of remuneration can be. But I'm at the stage in my life, you know what? I got what I want. I got three hots and a cot. I sleep where I'm sleeping. I got a couple of dogs. They, you know, I got Coco, the attack-trained police poodle. They're Coco, and my life's okay. I've got a good life, and I got a little physical stuff, but that's life. Everybody, you know what? Called getting older. When you get older, it's to break down. If you got an old car, it starts breaking down. I mean, that's just the life of things. It just starts happening. But you know, when you look at police use of force, look at it. When you look, oh, I should talk. You have to have probable cause under a Terry stop. That's stop and frisk. Probable cause. No. You hear attorneys talking about this. National shows. And hosts are talking. You don't have to have probable cause to stop someone under a Terry stop and frisk. Looks like a crime's gonna happen. It just happened, or it's in the process of happening. All you need, and this is the word, three words: reasonable, articulable suspicion. That is, well, I had my police instinct. You know what? Your police instinct is all well and good, but that has nothing to do with reality. It has to be a reasonable, articulable suspicion. And if you're able to substantiate, you probably, you never know again, you're probably going to be okay doing a stop and possibly frisk. Remember, it's not stop and frisk. It's stop and maybe frisk. It's stop, maybe frisk. And people, there's a lot of, you know, you hear, I hear things and I watch things happening and it's like nails on a chalkboard for me because I know the, not that I know everything, but I'm saying I do know. And that's one area I do know, and I hear this. And you got prosecutors saying, like the defense attorneys saying these things, and they, you know, they're talking out of the wrong side of their body to tell you the truth. Because they aren't talking anything using their brain power. But when you know, use of force, cell phone cameras, they good or bad? The answer is yes. They're good or bad. What they're going to do, remember, a two-dimensional representation, a three-dimensional event from one specific angle and focal point, without taking in things that I talked about Indian noises, other people present, a general topography of the area, other buildings that may be around or not around, the true lighting conditions, was it artificially well-lit, or was it total darkness, or the area where I at, was it well-lit? Outside of its surface where I can't see. These are all factors that officers have to take into consideration when they use force. And if somebody records it on video, may or may not be a video does no more or no less than it was designed to do. Is take again that two-dimensional recording of a three-dimensional event, one angle, one point of view. That's it. End of story. If you have any questions, give me a call here at Police Talk Radio. Our number, it's real simple. I even remember it. It's 602-753-1853. I'll repeat that. It's 972-753-1853. Now, you get into areas of use of force that I definitely not know area have an opinion on because I am not well-schooled in the area. That is police canines. I cannot render force expert's opinion considering concerning the use of police canines when it comes to use of force. Jimmy, you know that you know what I'm talking about. Would you feel comfortable about canines?
No, absolutely not. That's a highly specialized area that they, believe it or not, if you have a dog and you're a police officer, you probably have five times the training of any other cop on the street. And it's highly technical as well as highly a lot of legalities to it.
And a lot of hand. There's two schools of thought with dogs. There's the bite and lock, and then there's the bite and bite and bite and bite. You know, which is right? I don't know. I don't have an opinion because I don't know enough about it to have an opinion. Formulate an opinion. Nor do I want one. I'm at the stage. I know certain areas fine. You know, we could always use more. It's all right. The way I, you know, when you get anybody says, "Oh, I am an expert." Well, first of all, if they say they're an expert, they should never say they're an expert. You got others recognize me as an expert. People say I'm an expert. However, an expert in and of itself, that expert should consider him or herself a student. You should always want to learn. Always something new coming out. And if you don't learn it, somebody else is going to, and you may not be. You're representing whether a plaintiff or a defendant officer, depending on what you do. And I've testified against police officers, yes. I testified in cases involving department discipline and hearings. Would I do it on a criminal case? Yeah. I don't know of any cops that are criminals, because once they become a criminal, they're no longer a cop, in my opinion. If you commit a crime, you lose whatever status you had as a police officer. And I have no problems testifying against criminals. I want to see criminals put in jail. I will do everything I can. Criminals convicted. That's where they belong. They belong to be incarcerated. Should be incarcerated. They ought to be segregated from the rest of society. That's what they are. And that's the way I look at it. And There was a cop in Oak Brook Terrace. I don't want to get it wrong because it makes a difference. I was convicted of, I think, killing his second or third wife, and they were trying to get him back on one or two previous ones. You know the case I'm talking about, Jimmy?
Yeah, it was down in Will County, though. It wasn't Cook County.
It was somewhere Oak Brook something. Village Oak Brook. I don't want to say the wrong one, but it had an Oak Brook in their name. I remember that, and he was a sergeant. So he had him trying to get a contract out on the prosecutor while he was in prison. He's trying to hire a hitman to take out the prosecutor. Hell of a guy, huh? That's what that guy had going for him is something different. First of all, most cops I know would make terrible criminals. Honestly, they would make terrible criminals. They say, "Oh, they know all this stuff." Yeah, they got all. But you know, if they've been the longer they've been around, the more they know, the more you realize how people get caught doing things that shouldn't have done, and they did, and you start getting nervous. Well, am I going to do it? Am I not going to do it? You know what? Look at it this way. A police officer, if you're a good police officer, you're out there doing your job. You're going to make mistakes, yeah. You look at my delete key on my computer, it's almost worn out how often I hit it. I used to use a pencil. I'd wear my erasers out before I'd have plenty of lead left, eraser left. That's how, and you make mistakes. Cannot be a perfect officer. You show me a perfect police officer, I'll show you a liar. Because there ain't no such thing. Perfect police officers do not exist. Good police officers exist. Good police officers, are they going to make mistakes? You betcha. They are guilty of having the human condition, which means we make errors in judgment. We make errors in decisions. We make errors, I don't want to say all the time, occasionally. Even when you try to be very cautious, you will make an error. And if a good officer, let's say, sees someone that is being charged, and you find what they call exculpatory evidence. That means something to show that the person did not commit the crime that you have arrested or is a defendant. And you should bring it upon yourself. Say, hey, your job is not to see that there's a conviction. Your job is to work with a prosecutor and see that criminal charges are brought. And you did your part in presenting that. Find evidence that shows, hey, person didn't do anything wrong. They really didn't. They really didn't be charged. And you, you said something near Jimmy.
Yeah, I don't want to break your train of thought, but it was Drew Peterson.
Drew Peterson.
Bolingbrook, Illinois.
Bolingbrook, good. Am I glad I said Oakbrook? Bolingbrook. I know it's someone in Brooks in it. Bolingbrook, Illinois, and he was a sergeant, correct? Yep.
Yes.
That
and
was the guy, and he was a no. I mean, there's a slang ball. It'd been nice if he wouldn't have never been a cop. And then he did, and then he was a. I mean, at least one lady. Maybe two, maybe three that we know of their lives.
Number four.
And maybe others we don't know of, Jimmy.
Yeah, his fourth wife went missing.
Yeah. Yeah,
The two others died very mysteriously.
Yeah, I know this guy. Yeah, I mean, I remember the case, and I remember it not, no. But I remember when it came out, and I remember it. I did know a little bit about it. I'll tell you, you hear about this blue wall of silence. First of all, you can't get a group of cops to agree where they have lunch. You can't get them all to say the same place. They aren't going to want to say, hey, let's pass the word, frame O.J. Hey, let's pass the word, frame O.J. Word, frame O.J. We would have had to have something like 57 officers involved with that vast conspiracy, frame O.J. Simpson. If you have an IQ that's bigger than your shoe size, it's easy, I mean, to see how guilty he wasn't found guilty in criminal court. But he was had a degree of ability in civil court. And O.J. Simpson was when you look at the man, he was not a black man. He was not a white man. He was a rich man. He was a man with green, a man with money. That's what it told you about O.J. Simpson. He was a wealthy man. And usually, unfortunately, in our criminal justice system, rich people don't get often convicted and sent to prison. Is that right? Hell no, it's not right. I know that. But, you know, does it happen? Unfortunately, yes. It does too much. What value do we place on justice? Depends on how much money you got saved. That's going to go to your attorney. Whether that attorney's defending you, well, you know, at one time, again, I'm not here to crucify the legal system. The job of attorneys in our nation was to see, initially, when our Constitution was formed, at least my understanding of this, was to see that the state did the rules, they didn't cheat, didn't do anything to harm, and they didn't, you know, do anything sneaky or rotten or criminal themselves. And that was the that was the role of the attorney for someone charged with a crime. Well, now it's to the point now, and I don't care what any attorney tells me differently. If they get paid now, their job is to get their client acquitted, not to see that justice is rendered. It's to get their client acquitted. Simple. Their client acquitted. Once you understand that, that's a hard thing sometimes to swallow. I have a hard time, and I've been playing this ball game for 48 years now, and sometimes I think it's clear. The picture is starting to get clearer, and I look again. Sometimes the picture gets all fuzzier. It's more fuzzy than ever. The more I know, the more confused I get. And I think that you got to remember, it's like Goldilocks and the three bears with our legal system. Well, look at it. You're dealing with the bear family. Well, the bear family, there's the Papa Bear. She sits on there with the judge uniform on, the Papa Bear uniform. And then you have the prosecutor, and then you have the defense, or the plaintiff and the defense, depending civil or criminal. Well, they're like Baby Bear, and the Mama Bear. And who are you? You are Goldilocks. And their job is to make it tough for Goldilocks. And Goldilocks, you're going to get it because you're dealing with the bears. That's who you're dealing with now. And again, maybe I'm looking at it a little bit too simplistically. Maybe I'm not. But that's the way I see it. One thing I want to tell you, if you're new to listening to the show, if you listened last week, listening now, I'm always going to be straight with you. I'm never going to say that's a lie or no, it's a lie. If it's unclear to me, I'll say I'm not certain. I don't know if I have an answer, or maybe we could find an answer. Does anybody know? And I ask for the people have helped me, and I'll try to help people, and people will try to help me again. That's what it's about. So we all learn. If you do the same thing over and over and without changing it, that really is a mark of insanity. If you do it over and over and over and don't change it, you're insane, people. I'll tell you right now. If you don't, you should learn from it. That's the hey, your dogs will learn. I mean, they know when dinner time is. They know when certain times are. Even our, you know, our loyal pets that we have, our dogs. Again, I got to remember. Bodie attack train police poodle. One day I'll have Coco on here to give you his opinion on canine training. Joking, you know, I'm only goofing around. One thing you'll know as we go on in this show, sometimes I like to have a little bit of fun when I'm goofing around. And even when I'm not goofing around, I like to have a little bit of fun. But that's just the way I am. I'm serious, and I have a serious side. We all have a serious side. That's good. Once in a while, you know, in my years of being a cop, being around cops, you know, all my friends, not all of them, but 90% of them are cops. What happens is I find out some of the best cops have some of the best sense of humor. They have some of the best sense of humor you'll ever see. You know why? It helps you cope. That's what it does. It gives you an understanding of what officers go through. It gives you an insight to what officers go through. And I really, really, really believe that if you have a sense of humor, you know what's going on. I got the humor, you're able to go with the flow, you laugh at it. Sometimes you laugh when you should cry, and sometimes you cry when you should laugh. But good cops, all in all. In fact, I even said that. I think if you're going to have, of all these different skills, we try to, you know, the best thing we do, the best test for being a police officer, you know what? I don't know. I don't know what's the best test. What do you want out of that officer? But I know one thing. If that officer is going to stay in police work for any length of time, that officer should have a manageable good sense of humor. Because sometimes you get a little bit, it's easy. And I found this when I was, you get a little too grab-ass at times. And that's you know, that's the nature of the beast. Nature of the beast. Sometimes you get a little bit grab-ass. You get a little bit goofy. A little bit lax. You know, you just, yeah, well, what happens? Jimmy, what am I leaving out of here, pal? I know you're my friend.
Well, you know, I think you covered it pretty much. But, you know, specifically when we're talking about the use of force, we're talking about basically a tool that I've always looked at from basically a defensive tactic standpoint. And, you know, when I have applied force in my career a couple of times, I've tried to do what was right. I tried to do the legal way, the professional way. And I think most of our young officers and even our old officers try to do the same thing. The problem is that they're trying to rewrite the rules for use of force. One of the things I think, and I could just contribute to the conversation, the general dialogue about use of force, is let's quit calling it use of force. You know yourself when you get in front of a jury, as soon as you say use of force, they think, okay, the cop forced somebody to do something, so the cop's making somebody do something against their will. Why not we just say, let's employ a tactical option? I employ the tactical option. That tactical option happened to be a firearm, or that tactical option happened to be OC spray or a baton. You know, the whole thing comes down. Go ahead.
Jim, that's a double-edged sword, too. Sometimes the juries might think you're playing games with a tactical option. What does that exactly mean? That means, how did I respond to that person when I used a reasonable amount of force necessary to that person? Because they say, well, these are your options. Well, you could have shot him. I mean, you could have used a baton. So why'd you pepper spray him, officer? See, that it, sometimes we was the baton reasonable? Yeah. Was the pepper spray reasonable? Yeah. And officers, and this is what a lot of people don't understand, officers are making decisions. In a heartbeat. And, I mean, they're making decisions, tense, uncertain, rapidly evolving. And the Supreme Court recognizes that. And a case will go in front of the United States Supreme Court, be decided upon years later, and you can't get the Supremes to rule 9-0. It'll always be like a 5-4 or 6-3 or whatever. And the rarely do you get a 9-0 or an 0-9 or whatever. Rarely is there any degree of unanimity in a court decision. And a cop's got to make that decision heartbeat. If that cop hesitates, that cop is dead. If the cop if the officer uses force, and the cop shouldn't use force, causing someone to use their life. I mean, you're making a decision in a heartbeat. That's why that standard that the Supreme Court already used, Graham versus Conner, the reasonable officer standard, is a wonderful thing for everyone. It's a wonderful thing for the people out there that may sit on juries. It's a wonderful thing for the police officer. It's a wonderful thing for the people that are subject to having on them by a police officer. We're coming up to the end of the show, Jimmy. I can't believe it. This went by 90 minutes, and I know I talk fast, so if you slow me down, this would probably be a 2.5-hour show.
Well, Ed, just go ahead and close it out. We're down to about 30 seconds, so I'll just say my say.
All right, people, you've been listening to Police Talk Radio with Junebug Jersey Jimmy Smith, and this is Ed DeWicke, Big Ed, every other Thursday, but we'll be here next Thursday for 90 minutes. We'll be here on 9th of February from 7 to 8 Central. That's us.